Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Vox podcast. Hosted by me, Alan Scally, and my fellow Vox aficionado, Saulo Valerio.
Hello there.
It's the podcast that brings you insights and interviews from the world of Vox amps and instruments, past, present, and future. This episode transports us to California for an exclusive behind-the-scenes interview with the team responsible for designing Vox guitars. We take a look back at how Vox were innovating back in the 60s by merging guitars and electronics, and in later decades when artists such as Prince chose to play them, and then take things right up to today's pioneering models and discover the design ethos behind them. Join us now as we meet with Rich Lasner and Eric Kirkland from Vox Guitars R&D. Hey guys, how's it going?
Great, how are you doing? Good to see you.
Good to see you too, and thanks so much for joining us for our podcast today.
Absolutely, looking forward to it.
Happy to be here.
Great. So, Rich, you can just tell us a little bit about yourselves, both of you, and indeed about Vox Guitars R&D.
Well, I'm Eric Kirkland, and I'm the chief designer, I suppose, for Vox Guitars. Been with the company since 2007. Before that, spent some time with Gibson in Nashville, learning how to make guitars, and some time with Line 6 in various cities in California, learning how to do technology-oriented products.
Sure.
Okay. I'm Rich Lasner. Hi. I'm the VP of development at G-Rock R&D, which is Vox Guitars. And we do all the development work here in Northern California with our crew, which includes myself, Eric Kirkland, and Bob McDonald, who is the guy that runs the CNC machine, does all the computer work to get that to run properly and builds our prototypes for us.
Right.
I started working in the guitar industry, the commercial guitar industry, in 84. I joined Ibanez after working in guitar shops for a long time and also apprenticing with a builder to learn my craft. And I was there through the Vi, Satriani, Jem, George Benson, Paul Gilbert, Ed, you know, endless amount of great players. So I got to really work with some really good people, and I was in charge of the design shop and also all of the artist relations stuff. So I moved on from there to Yamaha. I did the Pacificas, the Billy Sheehan basses, Weddington Electrics, and a bunch of other stuff for them. Really good experience. And after that, I was down in Peavey, and I actually worked on other amplifier stuff. I popped after that to be the president of Modulus Guitars. We did the Flea basses and a bunch of other really nice equipment. You can see I bounced around quite a bit here. And, I'll get to the end of the road really soon. But okay, so after that, I was tapped as a consultant to Line 6, where I met Eric. And we worked on the Variax project there. So our history goes back even further than the 17 years or so or whatever it's been that we've been doing this. At one point,
14 and a half, I think.
14, yeah. Well, I was actually there a year earlier to kind of set it all up. So I think I'm a little skewed compared to you. But we were the team, and Bob McDonald had worked for me at Modulus for years. And then he moved down and worked with us at Line 6. And we got to a point where we were thinking we wanted to develop some guitars that weren't Line 6 style, heavily leaning on the electronics end of things. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make some more organic stuff, but we thought it really needed to have a purpose and a reason to live. So we got together with Korg USA at that point and kind of laid a plan out for them, went to Japan, explained it to the management over there, and they green-lighted it. They gave us the ability to move forward, and that was the start of the road that we were on today.
Great. Wow. Thank you very much for that summary.
Certainly.
Let's just go back in time a little bit here. So Vox, a lot of people out there will know about Vox's legacy of guitars in the 60s. Some famous body shapes, some famous players. But there's probably many listeners who don't know anything about the guitars that Vox was making back in those days. Could you just give us a little recap on that period, perhaps?
Well, it starts around 1960, certainly the very early 60s. Some of the earliest guitars that Vox started producing around that time actually were imported from Japan. There was the Shadows model.
Yeah.
As everyone probably knows, Hank Marvin started playing Vox amps around that time. And even though he was playing a Fender Stratocaster, in his earlier years, he was playing an unusual guitar called the LG50, right, which was imported from another company. But then Vox got the rights to import that from Gaiatone. And then that became one of the earliest models. They also were doing domestic production They had things like the Stroller, the Clubman, the Apache, which were made by local like cabinet and furniture makers.
Yeah.
None of that really caught fire until they came up with the Phantom Shape, though. The Phantom Shape, they had they'd asked the London Design Center to give them a shape, and they gave them this shape, and that started with UK production, and a couple of years later was also made in Italy and ran through 1968, I believe.
Right, okay.
Yeah, something interesting, Alan, that you brought up that I wanted to add to that is right after the era that Eric's talking about, Vox started building effects and electronics into their electric guitars, which was a very unusual move at the time.
Sure.
You know, pedals were just starting to come into their own. Guy might own like a fuzz pedal or a few years into it, a wah-wah pedal.
Yeah.
But to have these things building the guitar is something that Vox has done since the 60s.
They had a real commitment to that idea because it wasn't a one-off at all. They in 1965, they did the deluxe versions. They were called the deluxe model of like things like the Phantom and the Mark guitars and even the sort of Telecaster shaped new Escort. And then a couple of years later, they did a revised version, which had unique names for each body shape.
Do you think there was like a specific reason for that? Was that artist led, like people coming up to them and asking, you're saying, what do you know what would be really cool? Yeah, or was that something that Vox themselves thought, we think we've got something here that people might appreciate?
That's a good question. So some of this, some of finding some of the details about the early years of Vox is kind of like archaeology.
pretty random.
Yeah, I don't think we have the Rosetta Stone on some of these things yet.
Yeah, no historic records, I suppose.
They were just trying to get by. I think the reason for some of the unusual shapes and the innovation of putting things in the guitars, and we'll touch on the guitar organ too, because that's actually a pretty impressive piece of work, is
it is
you know, for an English company making guitars or importing guitars and trying to compete with Fender, Gibson, Gretsch, Rickenbacker, all the stuff coming from the States that was, you know, too expensive for most people over there, but a lot of your top guys were playing them. So I think to differentiate themselves, things like the Teardrop, the Phantom, some of the more unusual things, the guitar organ, it's like, we're not the same.
Yeah.
We do different things. Hmm. If you want X, Y, and Z, take X, Y, and Z. If you want to try something new, something going in a different direction, Vox has that for you.
It also gave them a chance to leverage technology that they already had, because obviously they were already making organs. They were already making effects.
Hmm. Yeah, they knew how to make and use all that stuff. And in a lot of ways, they were alone in the guitar industry. Mm. If you looked at Gibson, Rickenbacker, Fender, Gretsch, Guild, you know, anybody else in the States or all the guys in Germany, they were craftsmen or woodworkers or, you know, commercial concerns making electric guitars. They weren't trying to move into guitars plus electronics because that was something beyond what they knew.
Yeah.
So I would think that at some point, Vox said, hey, we have all this technology. We know how to make amps and effects. We can make pedals. This might give us a leg up.
Yeah.
It's all in the guitar. So
there were various ranges, I think, appeared in the 70s and 80s from when the Vox company had changed hands. But I think that the by far the more interesting period is somewhat more recently from, say, the early 2000s, right?
Yeah.
And that was the launch of the Virage.
Mm-hmm.
Semi-hollow guitars and some solid bodies. Can you just give us a quick summary of those?
Well, you know, the Virage was really interesting because when we all worked at Line 6, sort of towards the last year or two of working there, every now and again, we'd take a Friday afternoon. I had a condo right around the corner from the place, and we'd get a pizza and throw ideas around, like, what would you make? What would you design if it was up to you? What aren't people getting? What aren't players getting that could be interesting and unique and somewhat different? And we tossed around this idea of sort of a potato chip shaped, you don't call them chips, crisps, a crisps shaped electric guitar where you had a thin hollow body, semi-hollow body guitar, obviously not a little tiny machine, but it was curved in the ways that only solid bodies had been curved before. So we carried that idea with us, and Eric did all the design work on that, including the inner structure of it, which was really unique.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the basic idea of the shape is obviously you have the same silhouette, but if you just project that over a curve, then it creates this three-dimensional flowing thing, which would be impossible to make without CNCs, really. Luckily, we had our own little CNC in the shop when we started G-Rock in early 2007. And so we could take an idea and cut it out. And the first one, you know, didn't work. Second one was closer. And after a couple of tries, we actually got the concept working pretty quickly.
And by the way, all the ones that didn't work are still in a pile in the corner next to my desk. They haven't moved. It's really strange. Yeah, it's like it's becoming vintage as we speak. Now, one thing to think about with the Virage, too, is we decided that they would be combinations of solid tone woods. They weren't laminated, as is usual in a semi, you know, a semi-hollow guitar, yes, like right, a 335, or that's a classic, right? And that's a good sound, and that's its own thing. We wanted to build a livelier instrument and try to control some of the tonal qualities of it by combinations of woods. You were able to get ash with mahogany, all mahogany, all ash. You could get a couple of different things, and the guitars did sound different. And also, because they were solid wood, and Eric can speak a little bit about what the block on the inside was, because that was a pretty nice piece of trick design.
Yeah.
The guitars were really light.
Yeah.
That's so you got
super comfortable, small, responsive guitar. And the last thing I want to add about those guitars is, well, we wanted to have them be very versatile without having batteries in them. So the Virage always came into the world with a three-position switch for each pickup, which was very unique, that went from simulating a single coil to a P90 to a humbucking. And it was pretty effective.
Yeah.
So you know, we were able to offer people a light, good playing, high quality guitar that looked pretty cool, we thought, had unique hardware, unique pickups and electronics, but any guitar player could just pick it up and play it.
Right.
You didn't need an owner's manual to get into this thing. And that was one of our things. It had to work for musicians. It had to be responsive, sound good, and play really well. And of course, we entered into the market right in the middle of the 2008 world market crash. So we had some challenges. Last thing I wanted to add about the HDC stuff that came later, especially the 77 that was played by Prince.
Yeah.
It was his favorite guitar for the last few years of his life. He bought it off the wall in his local music store in Minneapolis. Nobody approached him. Nobody tried to get him to play it, which if you know anything about him, that wouldn't work. He was his own man. He went in, played it, and went, that's it. That's my guitar. That guitar was laminated. We realized at a certain point that it could be made more like a traditional semi-hollow guitar, lower the price substantially.
Yeah,
because it wasn't made on a CNC. It was pressed like most laminated instruments. And again, it was still super light. It sounded really great. It had all the sounds in it. And people like Prince just snapped these things up.
Yeah. It still had very unconventional construction, though, because the entire center section of the guitar did have to have that arc. So you're taking the pressed top and back and applying that to this weirdly shaped center section, which includes the tone bars and everything.
Yeah.
So it still has all the ergonomic advantages of the original Virage, but a slightly different tone. And in fact, that series of guitars is when we started using a different pickup, which eventually went into the Virage 2. So it stood out from the original Virage pretty well.
Yeah. And that was a pickup that Eric developed. He develops most of the pickups that we use going forward for the guitars. And that's a hell of a skill for us to have in our group.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Normally, you'd have to go outside and go talk to great pickup manufacturers, but they've already got their own agenda and their own time frame and schedule, and they can't really do exactly what you hear in your head. They can send you some samples, but it's not going to be personally exactly what you want. So,
yeah, the first pickup, for example, on the original Virage was done with the help of DiMarzio.
That's right.
Steve Blucher at DiMarzio. And that worked well, but we wanted a bit more of an attack-oriented sort of sound, which you can really only get from having individual pole pieces. And so we designed the coax to have that. Basically, the idea with the coax was just to make it sound like a big single coil, but dead quiet.
Yeah.
And it works. Now, yeah. The current guitar lineup, including the VSB basses, which you guys are just getting.
That's right.
Yeah. Interesting thing with that. You know, I was a president of a bass company for 8 years. I'm well aware of the fact that bass players will use what works. They're, you know, they will definitely try more things than a guitar player will that are like off the menu. They, you know, 8-string basses, 6-string basses, crazy laminated woods, you know, multi-scales really common for bass, has been much longer than it has been for guitar.
Yeah.
And, you know, the VSP bass, it basically is a super lightweight short scale instrument that's really comfortable and easy to play. Mm. And we discovered when we made it and brought it to the NAMM show that we were getting a lot of attention for it because it weighs nothing. It still has enough wood in the body to have a nice, tight, punchy sound. And short scales are super popular in the last decade. Yeah. I mean, it's a sound that you hear everywhere. Mm. So you can play a unique, lightweight instrument, doesn't cost a fortune, sounds really good, and it's easier on your shoulder for 3 sets a night, which people are going to start doing again really soon.
Yeah. I know. Having played it, it is really comfortable, and I really like the humbucker model. That's my favorite. Mm. And just for the benefit of our listeners, we should say that these basses have an outer frame, right? Which what is that material for the frame?
It's ABS.
ABS, okay. Mm. And then there is a wooden inner body, if you will.
Yes.
So and these are called the Starstream via the VSB series, and it's the Starstream series.
Yeah, and again, all the stuff that makes it sound right is incorporated into the wooden body section. All the hardware, the pickups, the neck joint, it's the same as any regular full-bodied instrument, but we were lucky enough when we put it together that we realized it was punchy and focused and didn't lack anything. And like I said, we showed it to bass players at a Winter NAMM show a couple of years ago, and they wanted to buy it on the spot. Mm.
Yeah.
It's so lightweight and it looks cool. Okay. Yeah. Bass players, they like to be in the background and subtle, but they still want their mom to notice them. So like, think about this. Somebody may eventually play one of those on a show like Top of the Pops or Saturday Night Live or something like that. And you're going to see it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, that's, you won't go, sure. Oh, I think that's a jazz bass. I mean, it's going to be like, what is that? Mm, yeah. So it's a nice calling card for us. The rest of the current lineup?
Well, we've got the SDC Mini, first of all.
That's a really fun little instrument. Again, there wasn't a lot of fun being had right before the pandemic. You know, I mean, as it started to slide into it, we realized that people aren't going to be going out. We also realized that if you just want to have fun with an instrument, something that isn't a lot of money out of pocket, but it's functional and you could take it anywhere because it's small enough that it's, you just put it in one hand and drag it with you. But we didn't want to do what every other mini guitar company did, which is tune the thing up, you know, like 3 or 5 frets to make it play above the regular tuning. Because what we realized with testing things like this with people is a lot of guys just want to play open position chords and they know their songs that way. Mm. And if they go to play with somebody, and they have to learn how to transpose a song to play with their friends in a garage band.
You've lost them.
Yeah, they're not going to do that. They can't do that. That's asking a lot of a casual player. Mm. But like, oh, okay, we're doing this song, but you're in like the wrong key. So we'll give you 5 minutes. That's not going to work. Mm. So the maths helped us here, as you might say. The diameter of the string over distance at tension, we were able, mostly through trial and error, we weren't using a Cray supercomputer, we were able to get it to tune to standard pitch with a certain set of gauges of strings on a certain scale length. So when you go show up to sit in with your buddy or play in a garage band or just take it to a party, all the open chords are in the same position they are in your full-size guitar. Mm. And it's the same exact pitch. So you just plug it in and go. Now, admittedly, because of the really short scale, anything like that, if you press too hard, if you're not aware of your touch, you can push it. You can push it out of tune because the shorter scale length means that every incremental change in the tension on the string moves faster, sharp, than it does on a much longer string. But once you get used to that touch, you can use this thing all day. And I've noticed some other companies have started copying us on this recently. I've seen some press releases going, oh, we tuned it to the same pitch as a regular guitar. And I'm thinking, where do you think they got that from?
Right.
The challenge, though, when you do that is making it play with proper intonation. Mm. Because the shorter the scale length, the more compensation you need, the more like the longer the string has to extend beyond the theoretical scale length in order to play in tune. Also, the larger the string gauges, the more compensation you need. So we ended up needing to make some tweaks to the bridge design with special springs and screws to maximize the saddle travel.
All right.
Got it.
So they could be properly intonated.
And it worked.
Great.
Eventually. Yeah.
So let's move on to probably my favorite guitars from the lineup, which is the new Bobcats.
Ah.
Could you just describe them in general for the listeners, please?
Well, the Bobcat really is, it's not a replica, it's not a vintage reissue, but it's kind of a reimagining of the concept of the original guitars that it's based on, adapted for the taste and needs of modern players. So whereas the original guitars were bolt-on, these are set neck, and whereas the original guitars had quite high bridges, these have bridges more in the standard range that you'd find in a semi-hollow guitar. The original guitars were, in fact, though they look like semi-hollows, they were full hollow bodies.
All right.
These are just about as light as the originals because they have a weight-relieved spruce center block. So still got the resonance without the weight. And we were really happy with the way that turned out. And we've also tweaked the pickups. I mean, the vintage Vox pickups are a very distinctive sound, and they certainly have their fans. But someone who's not a Vox fan who comes into one of those guitars, it doesn't really sound the way he expects it to sound, because it doesn't sound like, from looking at it, it doesn't sound like you would expect. So we made them sound like the player would expect. Changing the voice of the single coils to be a more familiar single coil voice.
Yeah.
And the V90 pickup actually isn't even directly inspired by anything Vox did in the past. That's just sort of an alternate voice for the series of guitars. It's kind of a hybrid of a P90 and a conventional single coil.
Got it.
Right. So in comparison to the vintage pickups, let's say the single coils, for example, have they got a lot more output than what the current ones I would expect?
No, it's not really. It's not so much output, but it's more voice. The original single coils had 6mm pulls.
Right.
So there's a lot of that's quite a heavy load. So it had more load and less wire, basically.
I see.
So it's going to have a different voice. And our pickups have 5mm pulls, which is more typical for a single coil. So it does, and the wind is much more on the order of what people expect from a single coil. So basically you're getting those single coil sounds on a semi-hollow guitar, which is a pretty unusual combination.
Pretty unique, yeah, very unique.
Another major thing there that Eric touched on is the original pickups were very microphonic most times. They squealed, they had feedback problems, and the guitars were completely hollow. They were
part of their charm, really.
Yeah, kind of. You can use it. They were sort of heavily built, so they didn't squeal as much as some other thin wood hollow instruments, but we silenced all of that in the current ones because contemporary players can't put up with that.
No.
You can't have pickups squealing and the body feeding back because it's got a resonance that won't go away in the room that you're in or where you're recording. Yeah. So we made them user friendly and better sounding while still retaining the white plastic, the vibe of the original one, the traditional Vox logo going down the center of the guitar. So it throws the shadow of the originals and references back to it, but it's a much more usable contemporary guitar. And we're starting to see them show up in the States now, and I'm sure you have some.
Yeah.
And I just sent one off to Elliot Easton from the Cars yesterday. He saw the thing. I'm talking about the visual aspect of this. He hasn't touched it yet. He saw it, and he's a Voxophile, right? He has original AC30s, AC15s. Mm-hmm. He just lives for that stuff, right? He saw that guitar and called me on the phone and just said, I gotta plug that into my AC30. It's too good to not do that. So we're starting to get a visceral reaction to the look of it, how it presents itself. And I'm hoping that since we work so hard on making it play well and sound good, that once people look at it and go, oh, that looks kind of cool, they plug it in and think, ah, I can use this guitar. It's a good sounding, good playing guitar.
Yeah.
So we're really happy with these instruments. I mean, we think we've got something good here. And I've noticed some UK magazines have reviewed it already.
That's right.
Yeah. And gave it really good reviews.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we had something called the Editor's Choice Award in Guitarist magazine.
Guitarist.
A couple of months ago, which was...
Good.
You know, they don't give those out lightly. So that was great to see that.
Will they be mailing us the awards then?
Yeah, we'll accept them on Zoom.
Yeah.
Eric, could you talk a little bit about why it feels so light, what you did with the center block?
I mentioned that briefly earlier, that instead of the full hollow construction of the vintage Bobcat and Lynx and the related models, we just have the center block is made of spruce. So, which is, you know, naturally a tone wood. And we also have some strategic cutouts in the center block to make it even lighter without compromising the resonance. So there are some other makers that have started doing semi-hollow guitars with spruce. And, I think ours is unique at our price point. I think that's typically a pretty high-end feature.
And is that completely different from the tone bars that were used in previous guitars like the HDCs?
Oh, well, they are. It's different in that it is a full center block.
Right.
The tone bars on the HDCs and the Virage extended only as far as the bridge. So they didn't go all the way to the tail block.
These do.
Yeah, let's talk about the Giulietta's. So what are the Giulietta's, Rich?
You know, we looked around again. Vox tries to do slightly more interesting things than maybe the typical response to, you know, what does the guy that's up front in a band want to sling around his neck? He's a guitar player and it's important, but he's really the focus of everybody that's watching the band. What's he got around his neck?
Yeah.
And we thought, this is one level of the Giulietta. What if it was a small bodied, super lightweight thing that looked like a jazz guitar, but it had a couple of unusual functions on it. They're two separate models, obviously. One sounds very much like a flat top acoustic guitar when it's plugged in. Mm. And Eric will speak to the bridge at some point, because that was a tremendous piece of design that we patented, that he developed. And the other one has a modeling system in it that was originally developed for a previous instrument that was not a hollow-bodied, small jazz guitar type of instrument. And I use jazz guitar because it's the visual cue that people usually, they look at that and say,
yeah,
you know, sound holes, arch top,
that's it.
that kind of traditional look. Oh, that's a jazz guitar. Yeah. Well, it's not.
That's right.
It's not just a jazz guitar. There are two of them, right? One of them looks like a really clean jazz guitar with no pickups on it, but it's actually in the bridge and it was tweaked so that the resonance is really similar to what you get when you hit a flat top guitar, which nobody's ever done before. Mm. And the idea was that if you're a singer in a band or you're up front and you're going to be holding this thing, you could have a whole different look and vibe. Yet what comes out of the instrument sounds like what people would expect if you were playing a good flat top guitar. Mm. So that was a challenge we made for ourselves. And the other thing was the modeling version of the guitar, same instrument, same neck, same body, same everything, one pickup in the neck, but then there's an entire modeling module on the side. And I have to tell you that when Eric and I saw the guy that was working on this in Japan several years ago, really, we were feeling bad for him, because the resonances that you get out of a fully hollow guitar with an arch top and a jazz bridge on it are not conducive to like a flat frequency response that most people want to work with when they're doing sound design.
Yeah.
It's got peaks.
The harmonics all over the place.
Yeah, it's got crazy peaks and valleys all over it. The guy, and, you know, we work for Line 6, so we understand the complexities of trying to put modeling into a guitar. More or less a hollow body jazz guitar with a floating tailpiece and a floating bridge. Anyway, we couldn't believe the level of stuff that this guy was able to produce. We were sure it was going to be... not quite. We're not happy. Back to the drawing board. And he did it. Mm. So again, it's got the typical modeling things in. It's got a bunch of 12 strings, acoustic guitars, a sitar, electric guitars, and just a wide variety of stuff. And again, this is a great guitar, A, for a guy that's on stage that needs versatility and doesn't want to change guitars over and over and over again during a set, or also recording. If you're going into the studio, instead of schlepping six guitars with you because they all sound different, this thing will do the job. while looking completely like it shouldn't. And that's, but we like that.
Yeah.
Exactly. I like to surprise people. You know, it's like, oh yeah, oh, I don't play that kind of guitar. You know, it's not for me. It looks kind of like, I don't know. And then you plug it in, you go, whoa, that's a Telecaster. Mm. Whoa, wait a minute. That's a nice flat top. Wait, whoa, that's a sitar. Mm. What's going on here? That was the idea for that one.
And a unique aspect of the modeling on that Giulietta D is that the modeling is driven by both the magnetic pickup and the piezo pickup. Mm. That gives that does give the sound designer a bit more to work with. I mean, the challenges of dealing with the hollow body resonance is certainly real, but at least having two different sources to work from, then they do have some ability to really craft the sounds that we need.
So, yeah, we think they did a great job. You know, the only downside to any of this for us is we just had to explain it to you, right?
Yeah.
Because it's not it's not self-evident. And we're hoping that people adopt these instruments and they get some press and artists use them, and it would become more common knowledge that, oh yeah, this one does this and the other one does all these crazy modeling things. It's just reinforcement that we need from the public and from artists to really get the word out.
Yeah.
And that's been tough out here, because when they hang on the wall, they just look like small body jazz guitars.
Yeah, it's really hard to sell a guitar you have to explain. If it goes any deeper than Jimmy Page played one or Chicks Dig It, then you've lost everyone.
Yeah. Hey, Eric, could you catch us these guys up on the hybrid bridge design for the one that sounds like a flat top?
Yeah, the hybrid bridge is, Rich mentioned the one that sounds like a flat top acoustic, even though it is in fact an arch top. And that's really all coming from the bridge. Typically, when you have that sort of floating bridge, if you have a wooden saddle, like a one-piece saddle, string pressure is actually quite heavy, and it's going to deform that saddle to some degree. And on an electric guitar with like magnetic pickups, you don't really care. But with a piezo, if the bridge deforms to any degree, that piezo and the saddle have to be in perfect contact to get even string pressure all the way across. So we were just trying to solve the problem of that deformation, and ended up putting an aluminum section underneath the piezo and a wooden section on top of that. So what it ends up doing is changing the resonant frequency to the point where it does sound like a flat top. It doesn't have that sort of woofy sound that you expect from that you would expect from a little hollow body like that.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because you know there's several elements. The saddle is made out of one material. The top of the bridge, like Eric said, is made out of wood, and it's laminated to an aluminum part, and then they're all squeezed together under the string pressure, and it sustains far better than arch tops, which are designed to have intense attack and a really quick drop off.
Right,
in the amplitude of the note. Mm. So like a nice side effect of this is we'd hit it and it would ring just like you're hitting a beautiful flat top. So it's a really lightweight, you know, like nice playing guitar that a guy can hang around his neck and get all kinds of nice stuff. And it's just like he's using, the sound will be like he's using an acoustic flat top guitar, but the visual is completely different.
Yeah,
got it. On that guy. So, and we patented that bridge, the US.
Yeah, I should mention the version we patented is Bob McDonald's version. He had a simpler, but my version was too complicated. Okay.
Just going back to the modeling one as well, you mentioned, Rich, that actually use a combination of the bridge signal as well as the pickup near the neck. That's something pretty unique as well, isn't it? Because I think in most other modeling guitars or systems out there, typically, you only have one source that you'd be working with.
Usually piezos. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. This was sort of an ingenious thing that the guy came up with, because like Eric said, it expanded the palette of what he had to create the sounds from, which made it sound much more authentic and realistic, because he could get things like attack from the bridge saddle, you know, and he could hone that. He could make it anything he wanted to, but then he could get the warmth and the drive from the pickup. So the magnetic pickup and the piezo together gave him a wide field that he could pull from. You're right. Most modeling stuff just relies on the piezo, which just gives you one source to work from. Mm. And it's in some ways, it's more difficult, and it doesn't give you as many tools on the palette.
Yeah, I mean, and once it's the piezo gives you an indication of everything the string is doing, because it's at the it's at the it contains all of the harmonics of the string. But in order to get the sounds of magnetic pickups, you actually have to discard much of that information. So so starting from the magnetic pickup, it kind of helps. You have to do less to make it sound real. And that actually goes back to the original Star String guitars.
Yeah.
They used a similar
system. Started then. I guess the one thing we haven't covered yet is the supercapacitor preamp system. Mm. Essentially what it is it's a battery inside the guitar that never needs to be replaced that charges very quickly. It's a capacitor, actually. I shouldn't call it a battery. But what it allows you to do is you can just plug in the kind of cable that you would, any USB cable that fits, plug it into a wall charger, and in 20 minutes, you've got several hours of use already there. So you don't have to carry batteries. It's not going to go down in the middle of the night when you're on a gig and you can't use it, because you can just plug it into the wall in between sets and it'll be fully ready to go after your break. So this is something that's in other portable electronics that had never seen use in guitars before. And one, you know, we go through things like, well, what are weaknesses of similar instruments? Mm. Now, we didn't find many similar instruments to, you know, these guitars, but one of the problems with inactive guitars is if the battery goes down and you don't have a replacement and you're somewhere where you can't get one, you've got a pretty good size problem. Mm. So this supercapacitor preamp system and charging system allows you to never find yourself in that situation. So it's kind of a really nice use of something that you'll find more often in other parts of, you know, personal electronics industry.
That sounds really neat. So whereabouts on the guitar is the pickup system and the controls actually situated?
For the PS, the piezo, or the acoustic sounding version, the controls are actually underneath the pickguard.
Okay.
And on the digital modeling version, the controls are on the upper bout, the rim. See.
Okay.
They're recessed into the side of the guitar. The stealthy one, I've watched a couple of people try to find the controls. Because they're black and so is the pickguard. Once you can feel them, they're really obvious.
Yeah.
But I've had a couple of people go like, whoa, what's going on here?
Especially if it's people that are not familiar with designs of like some older archtops that have
controls. Exactly. They have little controls, roller controls. It's the same exact thing. It's a cool system, but you know, there should be like a neon arrow going like, they're here. Or a sticker.
Yeah. And you were talking about plugging it in. You know, it could be even the case, you know, nowadays people carry those power banks, don't they? That you could recharge that.
Yeah, have a portable power bank will recharge this thing in under 20 minutes. It's cool. Mm. I mean, I keep one of those with me all the time in my car just in case. And if you have that on your gig with you, you're never without power for your guitar. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you meant you kept the guitar in your car with you.
Oh, the Mini, of course. Yeah, in the trunk. It's a little melted now, but we're okay.
Well, I think this is a really exciting current lineup, Rich and Eric. This is these are some guitars that I really want to go out and try, and I hope some of our listeners get the chance to do that pretty soon.
Yeah.
And, you know, it strikes me that the current lineup is kind of like the legacy from those days back in the, you know, the 60s and 70s, when Vox wasn't just making kind of copycat guitars. It was looking for something new. And these really are something different, and they've got their own reasons for people to go out and try them. So thanks very much for giving us that roundup. That's been really interesting and really good to see you.
Yep, you too. It was really great participating in this, and always nice talking to you guys. Thanks for having us.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun, guys.
Take care. All the best.
Bye-bye.
That's all we've got time for today. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the interview, and see you next time.